Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode, episode 256 of the 8-Bit Adventures podcast. I am your host, Sean Hayes, and we've got some weird news this week, folks. Not gonna lie, there is some weird stuff going on this week. And then our deep dive. Oh boy, our deep dive is once again. Twitter. Oh, Twitter. Just TTRPG Twitter. I don't know. I go on Twitter once every couple of months, and I regret it every time. And this time has not been any different. Once again, a lot of complaining about D&D. We're going to talk about that. Just D&D as a role-playing game. Also, it's not been a great news week, so there's not really a whole lot of topics that are really good for doing a deep dive. So it naturally lends itself to that. I hope everyone's doing well. It's some very weird weather going through the area right now. At midnight last night, it was around 60 degrees, and it is now currently 28 degrees. it peaked at about midnight last night and then dropped and continued dropping from there. Very, very unusual. It did not rise back up during the day today. It just continued dropping. So very weird day, very windy day. We will need to be on the lookout for, hopefully no internet outages or power outages, just because we are getting, 50 mile an hour wind gusts occasionally. So there we go. All right. Now that we've gotten that done, why don't we get right into our news topics, shall we? Because this first one, as a designer, I've got some insights on it. First up is Capcom has announced the latest edition of Street Fighter 6. So we got to see what looks like a new fighter from the U.S., Ryu. They sort of have widened him by about 50%. Very, very broad, not even broad-shouldered, broad-bodied. They gave him shoes, and they gave him a big old beard that makes him very reminiscent of Human Shrek. So the big thing that people are talking about with this is the logo. So for audio listeners, the logo is simply a hexagon, like the outline of a hexagon with sort of very angular text that, an SF, that the boundaries of it, sort of match the shape of a hexagon. And then a little spray painted six in the corner. And the internet being the internet, it took them less than 24 hours to discover that this is basically an Adobe stock logo. You could just buy this logo on Adobe stock for about $80. For a smaller company, I think that's a fine price. Or even cheaper to do a logo design. But if you're talking about a big brand like Street Fighter and that really wants global appeal and professional marketing and everything, that's very cheap. I don't understand how that happened. It's so bizarre. And that it was so easily discovered. that it's not custom at all. It doesn't match any, because they have an existing Street Fighter logo that's the word art, and they opted not to go that route with this. Doesn't make any sense to me. Like it would be like, you know, if Nintendo suddenly decided to use Adobe stock for like the next Legend of Zelda game instead of just modifying their existing Legend of Zelda like word brand, or I don't know, essentially like their logo, because like that's what they do, is they just like, you know, kind of modify that logo to fit the existing game, or, you know, like Monster Hunter, Pokemon, you know, really any sort of big thing, like Halo, Destiny. But it's just, you know, like for ones that have such a recognizable logo, to then not use it is a very bizarre, strange decision. So yeah, it's weird, but you know, hey, good news for folks that want to make mock-ups and, you know, essentially, do like parodies of it, is like, without even getting into like weird legal stuff, you too could buy the Adobe stock thing for $80, and then be able to make your own parodies that are legally allowed because you have the rights to that stock art. Oh boy. All right, let's get off of this. All right, so Uncharted had a pretty good opening weekend, $139 million globally. It made money, and Sony is calling it a new hit franchise for the film company. So we could expect to see more of Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. Who knows? Maybe they'll make as many movies as there are games in the series. So we'll see. You know, I wonder, I don't think I saw in the articles like how much it cost to make. So I don't know how much profit it had. I'm just curious. Okay. Oh, that's weird. Oh, wait, no. Oh, no. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Yeah, no. So that's good. Those are good numbers. It was trying to look up like other video game films and seeing what they pulled in. Oh, actually, Sonic would be a good Sonic movie revenue opening weekend. I was trying to look up Warcraft. Oh, Warcraft, disastrous. Okay. So Sonic pulled in, hang on, global revenue. What? No. Seriously? Sonic the Hedgehog. Okay. So Uncharted did pretty well. You know, it made money opening weekend. Sonic the Hedgehog made almost $320 million worldwide on opening weekend. That is, wow. But I guess Sonic is much more recognizable than Nathan Drake, so who knows? But anyway, yeah, Sony's happy. Sony is likely going to order sequels, so who knows? Maybe we'll get to see more video game films that do well. So yeah, good on them. And there we go. It'll give Tom Holland more roles outside Spider-Man. How about that? So next up. Epic Games is offering full-time employment to a few hundred currently contracted QA testers and other similarly contracted workers. Jeez, it's a tongue twister. So this is likely to capitalize on Activision Blizzard having their layoffs of similar folks, and then, you know, when they tried to unionize the remaining people, they then like broke them up and put them on other teams. Epic still will utilize temporary contract workers as needed in the future for ramping up production on things. But they are switching a whole bunch of these contract employees over to full-time employment. They said most of those offers, think are happening like April 4th. But I don't know if that means that like people are accepting them and they start April 4th or if they're going out April 4th or whatever. But yeah, so several hundred people, you know, I mean, Epic still has had some, you know, not great, practices, but, this is a good move. All right. You know, moving from contracted employment to full-time employment and literally just doing the same thing, that's good for employees. So, yeah, I mean, I saw one of the comments that's like, it's important for when companies, you know, do good things to call that out as well. You know, obviously hold companies accountable, but also make it known that when somebody does a good thing, to highlight that as a way to put like positive pressure to do good things. You know, on top of, you know, putting like negative pressure on when companies do bad things. So, so yeah, some good news for QA testers. Next, Elden Ring. This is just a reminder. Elden Ring releases this week. Given that it is going to be a very large scale, sort of single player, sort of, it's difficult to classify, because it is a Souls game, of whether it counts as like multiplayer or not. 'Cause like it has multiplayer components. Just a reminder to folks, be patient. Launch weeks are, especially for like online titles. Now granted, I don't believe this is an MMO. So it doesn't have as many of the pitfalls as, you know, like Lost Ark did. But just keep in mind, launch week is usually for when unforeseen problems happen with things. So I believe you can also pre-install, so that will also likely take some load off. So just some advice there. I don't really have any more information on that. Admittedly, I don't like Souls games. So this is not something that is particularly of interest to me. I think review embargoes also lifted. So, but I mean, you know, some of the headlines that I read, you know, high praise for it. So, for folks who are into that style of gameplay, I think you'll be pleased about it. All right. This has got to be the weirdest news this week. So Tom Brady, many time Super Bowl MVP, many time league MVP, Super Bowl champion, recently retired, has decided he's going to produce a road trip comedy film about four best friends on their way to see him compete in Super Bowl 51. So for those who don't recall, this is the one where the Patriots came back 20 and scored 28 points in something like 5 minutes to beat the Atlanta Falcons. This is apparently somewhat loosely based on a true story. As far as like the best friends going like on a road trip to go see Tom Brady. So yeah, just weird, weird. He's like kind of green lighting the project through his film studio. I didn't know he had a film studio. But it will star, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, Rita Moreno, and Sally Field. So you could say this is just Grace and Frankie go to the Super Bowl for those who have watched Grace and Frankie. That was a favorite series in our household. So, yeah, this is weird, folks. It's, I guess, you know, what do you do after you retire from the league after, I don't know, 20 plus years, you've got oodles and oodles of money. You go into filmmaking. I guess you go into sports commentary or you make films. Maybe, I guess. I don't know. No word on whether like any of the other Patriots players will be in the film. It would feel really weird to not have like Julian Edelman, because he was kind of integral for that performance. But it's also titled 80 for Brady. So I don't know what's going on. Oh, such a weird thing. It's just weird. Who knows? Oh, and that is going to wrap up our quick fire news for this week. As is it, it's not a whole lot of things happening. I think Majora's Mask also comes out this week. That's right, because they're releasing it on the same day as Elden Ring. So it's like, meh. Sure. But yeah, so that's coming for Nintendo Switch Online Extended Edition users. Elden Ring's probably the big gaming news that's coming this week. So, yeah, that is going to wrap up our quick fire news. So, buckle up, because it's time for some, I don't know if they're going to be hot takes, cold takes, take twos, whatever, for D&D. So, here we go. All right, so I don't know what prompted it. Because again, I check Twitter once every couple of months, and I regret it every time. But it seems like it's another round popping up of folks, I don't know, complaining sounds very negative. But of I guess expressing frustration over people like playing D&D and insisting that like D&D, you know, is fine as a role-playing game if you don't do any combat, and expressing frustration of like why people aren't just picking another game, any number of indie games in particular. And so I think that kind of boils down the overall argument. Again, picking this up from like the context of like sort of after a lot of the stuff had boiled over and everything. But that just seemed to be what the conversation was about. And basically, like, of D&D being a very combat-heavy game, and questions back and forth of, you know, whether like how much of D&D is actually focused on the role playing versus like, is it just a war game with role playing tacked onto it and everything? And I think the issue is, I think the issue is a lot more complicated than people are giving it credit for. Shocking. I know. Basically, I wanted to use this as an opportunity to do a little bit of investigative work. Now, I say that it's really more of like looking at data. And what I mean by data is taking a look at the stuff that's actually in Dungeons & Dragons. So I will say it with a caveat, all right? Obviously, I think part of the issue is how people feel about the game as opposed to what is actually in the game mechanics, right? Because I think that is a big component of this. I think... And often because I will, I would be very surprised if I haven't talked, I'm pretty sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, is that examples given for games that quote unquote do role playing better end up being rules light games. Number one, I think it's disingenuous to compare a rules light game to Dungeons and Dragons. Like, unless you're going to do it under the umbrella of that they both exist as tabletop RPGs. Sure. Yeah, like, that's, you know, obviously a comparison that can be made. But I think that it's not a great one-to-one comparison because they are different kinds of games. And so, you know, then it gets into the question of, you know, D&D has the market share and everything, you know, and the branding and stuff. Whereas, you know, indie games don't, but I'm going to come at this from a video games perspective. Obviously, we have seen the case recently, you know, within the past 10 years, I would say. In the video game space, indie games, you know, can perform very well. You know, without requiring, you know, giant budgets and everything. The ones that do well are ones that seem to have a lot of thought and a lot of depth to them. Now, I want to clarify that what I mean by that and the analogy that I'm trying to give is that I don't want to misrepresent and make people think that I'm saying that, you know, rules, especially like indie rules like games don't have a lot of depth to them. I think it's a case where they're, you know, and I'm just spitballing here, that maybe there's a perception issue, right? Where it's perceived that if your game costs $1 or $2 and it fits on one sheet of paper, like the entirety of your rules fit on one sheet of paper, that maybe folks will pick it up as a novelty and think that maybe it's good for doing like a one shot or something. But not look more into it. And I don't know if that's a result of having larger scale games like Dungeons and Dragons, like White Wolf, like White Wolf's games, and video games having a lot of, you know, depth of mechanics into them, especially for role-playing games. Because it's still the case where people are far more likely to be exposed to video games than they are tabletop RPGs. And I'm using TTRPG as an umbrella. Like, there are plenty of, you know, smaller scale games that don't necessarily have to be played on a tabletop. They don't involve maps or anything like that. As just a blanket term. So, you know, I think that might be part of it. I also have seen a lot of smaller indie games that go with a very niche idea. And that's the problem, is like, they either do something where it's like, oh, it's rules like D&D, or they go with a very niche idea. And there are issues with both approaches. So the first is, obviously, like, if you're going to do something that's like rules light, like D&D, but rules light. And what I mean by that is, you know, you do sort of high fantasy, you have classes or paths, or essentially it doesn't matter. You can call it whatever you want, but if it's like, you can call it character archetypes, you can call it jobs, you can call it roles, whatever. If it mimics classes, they're just classes. And I think you know, I think ultimately I don't know if like the public is becoming a little more savvy about game design and understanding that, right? And just seeing like, oh, well, you can call it this, but like, it's just classes, which are just archetypes, which are whatever. You know, high fantasy has classes, has abilities, your heroes going on an adventure. So like, if you make a role-playing game where you do that, obviously D&D is going to come up as part of the discussion. At some point, right? So I think if your shtick is like to fill that gap, but just be rules light, you have to really figure out what makes your game stand out. And then decide like, is it enough? And my concern is a lot of the games that do that, they stand out enough for people that are looking for something a little different, but they don't stand out enough to reach mainstream appeal. And it's just, I think about that sort of thought process a lot, because it applies to pretty much anything if you're doing any sort of content creation in this day and age. Whether it's you're a musician, you stream, you do art, you do comics, you do animatics, you know, it all kind of circles around to the same discussion. So that's just why I think about that a lot. So that's at the forefront. You know, and then if you make a really niche sort of theme and concept for your game, that means you might have a very dedicated audience, but it's likely going to be difficult to find mainstream appeal because it's niche. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, so I went through and I looked at, like combat versus non-combat stuff in D&D, because that's kind of where the crux of the discussion seemed to be. And I don't know if it's what caused it or not. And I think, no, I don't, you know, this is just based on, not even related to this discussion, but a lot of discussions that I've seen and questions that I've seen raised about D&D and everything is, if there's a perception issue that stems from the history of the game and memes surrounding the game, in that, like, every game might as well just be dungeon crawling. Because that's what it certainly feels like to hear about it from a lot of folks. And so, you know, I think there's some misrepresentation happening. And I think also it's, you know, that folks may just be legitimately missing some of this stuff. Because even for people that are enthusiastic about D&D, we see all sorts of homebrew happening for things that are already in the game. Like, they're trying to homebrew a solution, and they come up with something that's exactly like as written in, say, the DMG. just some interesting things that I came up that I found. Now, this is not including any class features from subclasses, because subclasses get into a weird thing where, like, they like all the subclasses for a given class have a set structure. And so if you start including subclasses, things can start to get a little wonky. For the most part, I think subclasses tend toward having more combat heavy features, with some exceptions. Beastmaster being a big one, Drake Warden also being a big one. So, you know, notably Rangers, Ranger pet classes. So that I just found it, but, in terms of class features, turns out the vast majority of class features are actually designed for utilitarian / non-combat / social exploration uses and not strictly geared towards combat. There are some exceptions. Fighting style obviously is one. Almost all of the barbarians class features, a whole bunch of the monks, and you know, basically fighters. Everybody else, like almost all of the artificers' base class features are geared toward like non-combat, or are agnostic toward which aspect of play. Rangers also very surprised at that. In fact, like, aside from, like, fighting style and extra attack are the only ones they get, like, as far as PHB rangers are concerned. Paladins, it's just like smite. And that's it. But again, so I think this also comes up with how do you define combat versus social? You know, for me, something that, like, improves saving throws, I don't consider that directly combat related, because saving throws could happen during any number of types of encounters. You know, it's basically useful for avoiding something to happen to your character. And that's when you would call a saving throw. So like, that's not necessarily combat related and in grid combat related. You know, it brings up a discussion of, is anything involving hit points directly combat related? I mean, you know, lay on hands restores hit points and can be used to cure diseases and poisons. Do you consider that a combat ability? Could that be considered agnostic toward which aspect of play? You know, I think being able to cure diseases and poison certainly has a lot of role-playing aspects to it. So I don't know. And then just the fact that outside of their subclasses, clerics, druids, and wizards pretty much have no class features. It's all spells. or recovering spells to some degree. So, yeah. So it gives you the flexibility for that. So then I was like, all right, let's take a look at spells. You know, I only looked at the first couple of levels, because I know it gets easier to kind of match them up as you get to higher levels. I know level 7 in particular seems like later levels seem to be where there's a lot more utilitarian options than strictly combat options. First couple levels, even split for stuff that is mainly used for role playing, for exploration, for solving problems. Could be used for solving puzzles, as opposed to just like fireball and roll a fistful of dice. That is looking at all of the spells that are currently available in the game as per D&D Beyond. So about half and half. Using same metrics, about 43% of feats. So not quite half, but pretty close. It's pretty close. There's also, one thing to consider, backgrounds. Everybody seems to forget about backgrounds once you get outside of, like, what proficiencies you get. And this is something, you know, I've talked about. Wizards, I think, could expand further on backgrounds and either have backgrounds give you more features as you level up or just give you more features, like, let you do interesting things. And I don't know if it's because of the tone that's intended for the settings, you know, where it's still supposed to be this sort of high fantasy, pseudo medieval, sort of era of that style. So, you know, maybe it doesn't make sense for backgrounds to give you 3 or 4 features, but you know, we've got Ravnica, we have Strixhaven. Trying to think of if there's any other ones. I mean, if we get Spelljammer, like, that's all out the window. Because now we're looking more at sci-fi or science fantasy. And so could definitely open it up more to having more background abilities. I think really what it boils down to is I think, unfortunately, there is and ironically, I think this is also the problem that ultimately did 4th edition in, is that there's sort of a graphic design and book layout problem. Because, like, yeah, there is admittedly, it's a short chapter on combat for D&D and how combat works. But what's interesting is, you know, nobody then talks about, like, the adventuring chapter, or nobody seems to talk about, like, the social chapters in the DMG, or sections, rather. Like, for those that don't know, the Dungeon Master's Guide of Dungeons & Dragons has, like, a whole section and I think this is something that could just be moved to the player's handbook in the future, of NPC, like, friendliness and, like, what DCs are to essentially ask requests of them or to get them to do things, and what generally, in very general terms, they're willing to do, at, like, certain DCs. I think renown is a great mechanic, that is very underutilized and could have used, a bit more fleshing out. I think that is the strongest point of the Ravnica book, as well as the Theros book. And just different ways in which they use renown and, like, different benefits you can get from it. That is essentially, like, a role playing to and rewards for just doing things. And they're often, with Ravnica, they are often role playing related. So, yeah, it's also, thinking about this, because, like, I was looking through a bunch of the threads. I saw one in particular that was asking, like, you know, what if I want to just be, like, what if the game I want to play and I just want to be a blacksmith that just, you know, sells swords to, like, the orc town, you know, two towns over. And, like, that's what I want to play. If your whole group is up for that, you can do that. The question came up of, like, you know, are there any non-combat classes? And it turns out, I mean, there's quite a few, actually. it's then just up to you to decide on your choices. But yeah, I mean, you pick Artificer, and Artificer has plenty of, like that right there is just, like, if you want to be magical and do that. If you don't want to be magical, I mean, you could literally pick any other class, you know, like, you could be a rogue. I mean, most of rogue. So, like, you know, sneak attack is obviously a very combat focused feature. Uncanny dodges as well. Like, evasion? Unclear. I would say it's certainly a dramatic action scene focused one, because dexterity saves are often related to involving explosions. As opposed to other things. Expertise, thieves can't, cunning action. You know, essentially cunning action is just that it lets you do other things on your turn. But anyway, downtime rules. So to go back to the example of, like, being a smith. If you want to be an artificer and use the downtime rules, or rules for running a business. I mean, there you go. And then for interacting with people, you could have spells that help you with that. You could pick feats that help you with that. You know, there's your background. And yeah. So ultimately, I think the take that I want to come away with is, because I know we're running a bit long. You know, essentially the question is D&D combat focused? And obviously, you know, based on the marketing, and how most games are run, yes, there is an aspect of combat to the game that can vary from group to group. You know, some groups might be very combat heavy in dungeon crawls. Other ones might not be. There is, you know, somewhere between a moderate to major amount of combat that is a part of the game. However, I do think a lot of folks overstate the combat. And just see that, like, just seeing numbers and modifiers and stats and everything, and assume that it's solely for the purpose of combat. You know, and especially like with the XP totals for monsters sort of a thing, which is ironic given that milestone or narrative based leveling is sort of the norm these days. It is an optional rule. But I would not be surprised if it got pushed more to the forefront in either whatever update they're doing or in the next edition, because, fun fact is, it turns out most people don't like tracking hit points, and are just more inclined, like, with when does it make sense with the story for people to level up. So yeah. You know, do I think D&D can do some social things better? Sure. Absolutely. It's also tough because, so right now is at its core, D&D does about the same as a bunch of other games do, like rules light games do, in terms of mechanics for playing the game, like from a non-combat perspective. And as it turns out, you could, you know, I don't know how well it would work. You know, I might even test an option for it, but like, I mean, you could conceivably make a combat light D&D by just having a fight skill, and then to simulate a combat, you just roll a fight check, and then that tells you how the combat went. that's what I mean by like other games that I've seen. Like, that's how they resolve things. So, you know, I don't know if D&D... I don't know if... I don't know. Ultimately, I think... My takeaway is just that it's a bit more complicated, and that it's not just, you know, Wizards has the money and the market share. Because there were plenty of other open world games that came out like alongside Skyrim and after Skyrim. And that were there was plenty of competition, but Skyrim still had a healthy enough community around it. Again, talking about a video game perspective, and it's obviously it's not a one-to-one comparison, but because I think part of the complexity that gets ignored is D&D's sort of mod ability. That, and if you have a rules light game, there's less to tinker with, which, you know, might have an elegance in its initial design so that, like, you don't end up having people tinker with your rules and everything. But I think that's also part of why D&D might be so popular. Is that not only can you mod it, but, like, you don't... Like, modding is incredibly popular in the video game community because it gives you all sorts of weird and wacky nonsense. But what holds a lot of people back from that is you have to have coding knowledge. Now imagine if the only barrier to entry is you've played the game before because, you know, technically... with pencil and paper role-playing games is you just need to know how to play the game in order to start modding it. So part of me wonders, you know, obviously not saying this definitively, and I'm not saying this as a knock against games, but for games that don't have as many rules, if it ends up being harder to mod them and to, you know, do all sorts of stuff because there's less to work with. In which maybe that's the intention of the creator. I don't know. I think that's a very individual personal decision based on the creators, but. So yeah. I say this as a person who, you know, at this point I don't get to play D&D because I run D&D, and I run it basically at the amount of time that I have available to me. So because I don't even get to play D&D, I don't really get to play anything else, you know? So, you know, although I'm happy to support other games, I mean, realistically, I'm never going to play them, you know? So that makes it tough, you know, and I don't know how many people are in my position, you know, I don't know. I think games are in a weird space. I think people are still trying to figure it out. So, all right. That's my thoughts. I don't know if it makes sense. I hope it does. But essentially, The takeaway is D&D has a lot more going on outside of combat than memes make it seem like. And that you can actually do a lot more with it than just running a combat murder hobo simulator. Fun fact, normally I don't like to make judgments on how people play. That's usually a very boring way to play D&D. Just saying. So, yeah. Also, another judgment is I don't know, a lot of the stuff that I've seen in other games that are supposedly quote unquote, that are being heralded as quote unquote better for role playing, literally just do the same stuff that D&D does. I'm sure that's going to get me in all sorts of hot water, but given the size of the podcast audience, I don't think I have anything to worry about. So, all right, now I'm done. Now I'm done. So, let's do quest log really quick, and then we will wrap up this show. All right, so we did get more Chapter 1 comics colored. I believe we're down to five. Five left. So very excited about that. Depending on how things may go in the future, I may start doing more art streams instead of game streams. We'll see. So that will help sort of speed up the process. But who knows? At the very least, we're making real good progress on coloring stuff. And then complete Bubble Gloop Swamp in Banjo-Kazooie, one of my favorite areas. Turns little Gator, who is one of the better forms that Mumbo turns you into. Also has Tip-Top, who's my favorite, one of my favorite characters out of the series. So yeah. Yeah, managed to get Clanker's Cavern done. I'm really enjoying the fact that, like, of how much I remember and how much I'm able to figure out in the game. Since, like, when I was little, I would, like, buy every strategy guide that comes out and would use that religiously to, like, look up everything and, like, try and 100% games. And so nowadays, trying to avoid that, unless it's a game that has a lot going on for it, like I did for Saga Frontier, where I was like, listen, the monster system is so complicated in that game, I have to look up stuff. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to figure it out on my own. And even with looking it up, I still often did not figure it out on my own. So, but yeah, so we're going to try and do that. As I said, I did get Clanker's Cavern all squared away and a Chapter 1 comic, so we're just going to get those, and we'll report back next week on how we're doing. So that is going to wrap up this week's show. Thank you all for joining me for this episode of the 8-Bit Adventures podcast. If you would like to see other episodes of the podcast, the comics, all that stuff, you can check out everything over at 8-bitadventures.com if you would like to help support that stuff, support all those great projects. The best way to do that is to become a patron over at patreon.com/8bitadventures. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. Every little bit helps. Big shout out and thank you to all of my current patrons. Thank you for your support. It means a lot to me. And the goal, you know, ultimately is if we can get a little bit more of that coming in, you know, be able to actually start putting everything under like an account where that Patreon money and Twitch money goes into, to be able to like pay for hosting and things like that. So, finally, opening theme for 256 episodes is One Up by Professor Shy Guy. You can find his work over at professorshyguy.bandcamp.com. So, big shout out and thank you to him for that. And that is our show. So, as always, have fun, everyone. Happy gaming. And enjoy your pie cake.